Well, brethren, can one day change the course of your life? You're going along today, something happens, and your whole life's been set, like it's been reset. You know, we hear songs and movies, oh, what a day. I don't remember just how that song went. I think there's one, oh, what a night. We don't want to get in that one. But there's one, oh, what a day. A day without rain. And an old movie, The Longest Day. Also, The Day the Earth Stood Still. I don't know if you'd remember that, an old sci-fi movie going way back. Aliens land a saucer in Washington, D.C. They come out and they warn mankind, you've got to live peacefully or be destroyed. So, you know, that was the day the earth stood still. And then there's the song, What a Difference a Day Makes. 24 little hours brought sunshine and flowers where there used to be rain. What a difference a day makes. There's a rainbow now before me. What a difference a day makes, and the difference is you. Do you make a difference? Do we make a difference? You ever thought about, did Jesus Christ make a difference in just one day? Did he change the course of people's lives in just one day? They were this way today, tomorrow, they were different. See, we see an example of what could happen in a day. And my title is A Day in the Life of Jesus. Just take a day, one day, and see what he did in one day. So let's look at an example of what could happen in a day in 2 Kings. In 2 Kings chapter 6. 2 Kings chapter 6. And, well, we won't get into the background, but Samaria is surrounded. The Syrians have gathered their armies and they've besieged it. And they've cut off the supplies. And there was a great famine in Samaria. And indeed, they besieged it until a donkey's head was sold for 80 shekels of silver. I don't believe they had coins then. Silver was just weighed out per shekel or by what we call pound. So just a donkey's head, 80 shekels of silver. One-fourth of a cab of dove droppings for 5 shekels of silver. People would be paying for dove down. Look at the prices then. And then the king had even found that people were eating their children in desperation. And that was one day. But then in chapter 7, somehow the king blamed Elisha for all this trouble. You know, you need to blame someone. Because he says here in verse 31 of chapter 6, he said, God do so to me and more also if the head of Elisha, the son of Shaphat remains on him today. And then Elisha was sitting there in his house, and he sends a message to him. And in verse 7, Elisha said, hear the word of the Eternal. Thus says the Eternal, tomorrow about this time, here's this day, he said, tomorrow about this time, a sheaf, maybe like 8 gallons is what I've been able to find, of fine flour. Remember what it was bringing, things were bringing the day before. Sold for a shekel and 2 shaves of barley for a shekel at the gate of Samaria. He said, people are starving today, tomorrow, right in the gate, food's going to be so abundant, it's going to be very cheap. So an officer who was on hand, on whose hand the king leaned, answered the man of God and said, look, if the Eternal would make windows in heaven, could this thing be? And he said, in fact, you shall see it with your eyes. Here's Elisha speaking. But you shall not eat of it. So here's a big, big change. It's going to happen in just one day. And in verse 18, it says in 2 Kings 7, so it happened just as the man of God had spoken to the king, saying, two sheaves of barley for a shekel and a sheave of fine flour for a shekel shall be sold tomorrow about this time. Then that the officer had answered the man of God and said, now look, even if the windows of heaven had opened, it couldn't happen. And so it happened to him, for the people trampled him in the gate because they were rushing out. The Syrian army that was surrounding them, God had spooked them off. They had all fled, left everything behind. Two lepers had gone out, said, well, we might as well go out. We're going to die anyway. They find it. They report it back. There's all kinds of food and clothing. And I think even the ground was littered with swords. And so this is how it happened. Now, nobody would have thought that out. That's what I've noticed when God answers a prayer. It's not the way I have it figured out. It's going to happen. It happens some other way. I mean, who would have thought this out? The guy, the officer said, well, this couldn't happen if God opened the windows. But see, what a day. What a day, what can happen. Now let's see what Jesus did in a day. Just look at some things that Jesus did in the day. Well, I think we'll see that he stilled the sea that was in a rampage. He cast out multiple demons. He fed people. He healed a woman who had been bleeding for 12 years. And he raised the dead. And Lord, I can tell in one day. I mean, that's keeping it moving, you know what? You're not watching much TV or doing much texting when you get that much done. So let's look here in Mark chapter 4. In Mark chapter 4. We had talked about this in the harmony class and some of the amazing things that Christ did during his ministry. But in Mark chapter 4, verse 1, and again, he, Jesus, began to teach by the sea. And a great multitude was gathered to him, so that he got into a boat and sat in it on the sea, and the whole multitude was on the land facing the sea. So he could speak, they could hear him, he's on the sea, it's calm. And he begins to speak. And then let's look at verse 35. Mark 4, verse 35. On the same day, when evening had come, he said to them, let us cross over to the other side. Here's the Sea of Galilee. And he said, let's go to the other side. Well, the other side was the Gentile side. If you were looking north, you had the Israeli or the Jewish side be on the left, and the Gentile side was across the sea. So he's going over to the other side. The east side was a Gentile area. I believe that's where the Golan Heights is, if I am correct on this. And, you know, we've heard, you know, they send missiles off of there because it's high up. I think it's like close to a 4,000-foot drop in sea level. in the, as far as the sea on that side. So, yeah, the Encyclopedia Britannica says the Sea of Galilee is about 8 miles wide. So they, you know, sailing ship or paddling, and it's 13 miles long. And it's 700 feet below sea level. The Dead Sea is lower, but this is probably one of the lowest seas that I know of. The hills of Lower Galilee, where they were, they fall abruptly to the lake's edge also. Yeah, and the cliffs of the Golan Heights are on the east side. And storms can abrupt very quickly there, because you got the drop-off and the low sea and the wind gets right. And in verse 37, Mark 4, and he permitted no one to follow him except, I'm in 5. Mark 4:37. And a great windstorm arose, and the waves beat into the boat so that it was already filling. I assume this isn't that large a boat. I don't know. You know, you're 700 feet below sea level, and you got cliffs, and storms can arise very quickly so that it was ready to fill. But he, Jesus, was in the stern asleep on a pillow. He's just sleeping through it all. He's got a pillow and he's taking a nap. Well, all he gets done, I can see that. And they awoke him and said to him, "Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing?" Does that remind you of Jonah chapter 1? Jonah's fleeing from God. And he gets on the ship, and a big storm comes, and Jonah's asleep. He's asleep. And the crew members are in a panic, you know, and they finally wake him up and say, "You better go to your God and see." That'd be in Jonah 1, verse 3 and 5. So Jonah says, "Yeah, it's me. Throw me overboard." They throw him overboard, and what happens? The sea gets calm. So here Jesus here is, they're in a panic. "Do you not care that we're perishing?" And what does he do? He arose and he rebuked the wind and said to the sea, "Peace, be still." I mean, that's just not a minor incident. You know, that "peace be still." Here's a raging sea. And the wind ceased, and there was a great calm. Well, if we would turn over to Psalms, I'll be right back here, but Psalms 107, and there's several psalms that we could turn to about this, but I'll stay with Psalms 107 right now in verse 23. "Those that go down to the sea in ships, who do business on great waters, they see the works of the Eternal and his wonders in the deep." Verse 25, "For he commands and raises the stormy wind, which lifts up the waves of the sea, that they mount up to the heavens. They go down again to the depths. Their soul melts because of the trouble." I mean, they're scared. "They reel," in verse 27, "to and fro and stagger like a drunken man, and are at their wits' end. What do we do?" That's what they said to Jesus. "Hey, you know, you're sleeping. We're dying here, you know." "Then they cry to the Eternal in their trouble, and he brings them out of their distress. He calms the storm so that its waves are still." So who does this? Capital L-O-R-D. Y-H-W-H, the Lord. So we see Jesus here calms the sea. And there's other, if you want to see some more, there's Psalm 65, verse 7. I won't turn there now. It says, you still the noise of the sea. In Psalms 93, verse 1 through 4, the eternal on high is mightier than the noise of many waters. So see, Jesus could calm the sea, and he could make it calm again. I probably didn't read the rest of that in Psalms, but I'll proceed on. So now let's look at Mark chapter 5. We were there in 4. Remember, they were crossing the sea. The sea gets in a big storm. Jesus calms the sea. Then they came to the other side, there in Mark 5, verse 1, to the country of the Gadarenes. That's the eastern side. Remember that name. It's a, I believe it means 10 cities. It could mean something like that. And when he had come out of the boat, immediately there met him out of the tombs a man with an unclean spirit. Now, on the account of Matthew, it says there were two people that met him. So apparently there was one that was prominent. When Mark records it, he's basically concentrating on the one. So it says that Jesus stepped out of the boat. Is he the only one that stepped out? I don't remember. The rest of them maybe were afraid to step out. I don't know. But it says Jesus stepped out. It doesn't mention the other disciples. But Jesus stepped out. And this strong, violent man. And this man living in the tombs with an unclean spirit. And in verse 3, Mark 5, verse 3, who had his dwelling among the tombs, and no one could bind him, not even with chains, because he had often been bound with shackles and chains, and the chains had been pulled apart by him, and the shackles broken in pieces. Neither could anyone tame him. Well, demons in people can do really unbelievable things at times. We might look, I'll be right back here, but in Acts chapter 19, Acts 19, verse 13, see here were some Jewish men thought that they could expel demons by using Christ's name. Some of the, in verse 13, Acts 19, then some of the itinerant Jewish exorcists took it upon themselves to call the name of the Lord Jesus over those who had evil spirits. We exorcise you by Jesus whom Paul preached. So they heard about Jesus through Paul. And also verse 14, and there were seven sons of a Jewish chief priest who did so. And the evil spirit in verse 15 answered and said, Jesus I know, and Paul I know, but who are you? So, I mean, taking this upon ourselves can get dangerous, can't it? Well, I think I'll cast out a demon. No. May not be that simple. But he said, but who are you? Then the man in whom the evil spirit was leaped on them and overpowered them and prevailed against them so that they fled out of the house naked and wounded. These are seven men. And this guy, he sent them running, had their clothes torn off and battered, and they were ready to get out of there. That demon, or demons, however it was, he said, I know Paul, and I know Jesus, but who are you? So you see here, going back to Mark 5, that it says this man, He broke chains, shackles, no one could bind him. Neither could anyone tame him. I mean, this is a wild man. And always, night and day, in verse 5, he was in the mountains and in the tombs, crying out and cutting himself. This was a very foul man. To the Jews, I mean, he was doubly foul. He lived among the dead, which was unclean. He was naked, and he was demon-possessed. He was a very foul man. He was touching the dead and just being unclean. And what did it say there in 5? And cutting himself with stones. It seems that demons have a self-destructive attitude. Remember one time a man brought his son, you know, heal my son. He throws himself in the fire or in the water. He's trying to destroy himself. That'd be in Mark 9:22. I won't turn there, but it's just a reference that the demon attitude. Susan had told me a story about one of her employees who cut himself and had different things, you know, cut and self-mutilation. And she asked him why he did that. And when I cut myself, he said, I don't feel pain inside. So, I mean, this is a painful situation. And, you know, driving people to self-inflict and even kill themselves. So here's a man. This man has big trouble. And says, always night and day, he was in the mountains, in the tombs, crying out and cutting himself with stones. Verse 6, when he saw Jesus from afar, he ran and bowed down to him. Some translations say worshipped him. Others disagree. It's like he bowed down. Hey, here's someone far superior to any demon. And in verse 7, and he cried out with a loud voice and said, what have I to do with you, Jesus? He knew who this was. You remember the other demon in Acts, they said, I know Jesus and I know Paul, but who are you? No, he knew. And here's a man, as we'll see, possessed with multiple demons, and yet they were afraid of one man, Jesus Christ. Do with you, Son of the Most High, I implore you by God that you do not torment me. Or before the time. See, if we looked over in Jude, I'll be right back here, but I might read Jude 13. Where it says here, there are clouds in verse 12. Spots in your feast, clouds without water, carried about by winds, out of fruit, twice dead, pulled up by the roots. In verse 13, raging waves of the sea, foaming up their own shame, wandering stars for whom reserved the blackness of darkness forever. So he said, I implore you, do not torment me now. For he said, for Jesus said, come out of the man, unclean spirit. Jesus apparently realized that, hey, there's more going on here than one demon. Because it says here, then he asked him, what is your name? What is your name? My name is Legion, for we are many. Well, legion, a Roman legion at that time, from what I've been able to find, was about 6,500 men. 5,500 would be soldiers, then all the staff, the cooks, the cleaners, laundry people. you know, and apparently there was a Roman garrison just north of there in Syria, and which would have had multiple soldiers, and plus local garrisons maybe had a few hundred men. So there could have been a regiment there nearby. So he said, "My name is Legion." So just the idea what a Roman legion would be. And he's saying there in verse 10, and he begged him. Here's multiple demons, and they're begging Jesus. I mean, they know they have more than met their match. And he begged him earnestly that he would not send them out of the country or to outer darkness. I remember we read there in June, the blackness and darkness forever. Would not send them out of the country. Legion for me. And he begged him earnestly that he would not send them out of the country. And some translation might say outer darkness. And in verse 11, now there's a large herd of swine was feeding there near the mountains. So here's a large herd of swine. So apparently, it seems that demons cannot appear just as a person. They have to possess a person. But we know that angels can appear as a person, because in Genesis 18, in verse 1 and 2, we see that the Eternal appeared with two other men in verses 1 and 2. Matter of fact, with three men. And after they visited with Abraham, two of those angels went on to Sodom, and they rescued Lot. And the word angel there could mean to dispatch a deputy or a messenger, but they looked like men. And haven't we read somewhere that maybe we've entertained angels unaware? But apparently a demon just can't, he can possess a man, but he himself can't appear as a man. He has to possess something. See, they couldn't wait. They said, you know, here's a large herd of swine feeding there near the mountains. So all the demons begged him, saying, "Send us to the swine that we may enter them." We want to enter someone. You know, you probably remember reading that Jesus warned people, you know, after he's cast out a demon and everything's clean, and if nothing comes back in there, the demon's going to bring him and his friends back, and it's going to be worse than it was. So I think that's just a lesson that when we're forgiven or cleansed of something, if we don't replace it with God's way, with God's Spirit, then we're left vulnerable. We're sitting there empty. So anyway, they said, and at once, verse 18, so all the demons begged him, saying, "Send us to the swine that we may enter them." And at once Jesus gave them permission. Then the unclean spirits went out and entered the swine. There were about 2,000. There was about 2,000 swine there. So there was quite a number. But again, demons, they're wandering about, like almost like they're looking for a home. So we want to be sure we're never inviting that. So Mark 11, in the herd of swine, "Send us to the swine that we may enter them." There was like 2,000 swine. and say, what in the world were they doing with 2,000 pigs herding them? Well, we realized that that was probably a big food supply. That many pigs was probably a major contributor to the economy in that area. Pagans used swine in sacrifices and food. The Roman garrison probably took several of these animals continually. It wasn't far away. But we know that pagans used swine. The church has an article called The Coming Abomination of Desolation. And it talks about the sacrificing pig's blood, or it talks about defiling the temple. And in Daniel 11:31, I might turn there because I'm talking. Daniel 11, I'll come right back here. Daniel 11, I think verse 31. Let's see what we say here. And forces shall be mustered by him, and they shall defile the sanctuary, fortress. Then they shall take away the daily sacrifice and place there the abomination of desolation. And those who do wickedly against the covenant, he shall corrupt with flattery, but the people who know their God shall be strong and carry out great exploits. Well, from the book of Maccabees, which is an inspired scripture, but it is a history, that they talk about what Antiochus Epiphanes, is he the fourth, Antiochus the fourth? He was very cruel. He forbade the Jews to circumcise their children. And Daniel 11:31. And I understand that if they were caught, they would kill the woman and tie the baby around his neck and all kinds of atrocities. And the Maccabees resisted that, and I think finally drove that group out. So they did. The Maccabees said they did sacrifice swine, and they had built an altar on top of God's altar, apparently, and sacrifice swine and other abominations. And we know that maybe that was a forerunner, probably for sure, of what will happen again. So anyway, there is an article, The Coming Abomination of Desolation, and several others too. So in verse 13, and at once Jesus gave the permission, then the unclean spirits went out and entered the swine. There were about 2,000. And the herd, what did the herd do then? They ran violently to their death. I mean, I don't know what the demons are thinking, that somehow they can commit suicide or what. But they seem to be, they try to self-destruct. And so the pigs drowned, but you notice Jesus and his disciples on the water, they didn't drown. Even though a great storm come to drown them, they didn't drown, but the demons and the pigs went in the sea. So it's kind of like, hey, you got what you asked for. You got what you were putting out. I'm not saying that Satan caused the storm, but something did. And he is called at times the God of the air and wind. It could have just been a storm fulfilling prophecy, but the pigs ended up drowning, not Jesus and his disciples. So he cast out multiple demons, 2,000 swine dead. Imagine what that would do to that economy. You know, it probably provided meat, maybe for the Roman garrisons. And of course, those in verse 14, what did they do? So those who fed the swine fled, and they told it in the city and in the country. And they went out to see what it was that happened. So the people then said, what happened? Let's go out and see. I mean, there's 2,000 dead swine. And the people came out there in verse 15 to see. And what did they find? And they found, and they came to Jesus and saw the one who had been demon-possessed and had the legion setting and clothed in his right mind. And they were afraid. Tremendous change in this man's life. One day, he's sitting, he's clothed, and he's in his right mind. And of course, the people were afraid, it says. And those in verse 16 who saw it told them how it happened to him who had been demon-possessed and about the swine. And so what the people do in verse 17, and they begin to plead with him, depart from their region. They didn't want any more of that. Maybe their economy was damaged. And they said, please, depart. You know, when Satan, there's a man that was demon-possessed. When he was freed, what happened? He was dressed. Did Jesus miraculously have some clothes? I don't know how he clothed him. But we see, I won't turn there, Revelation 20, we see that after Satan is bound, mankind is restored to a right mind. You know, this is like a type there, that after the demons are gone, mankind is restored to a right mind. Remember that the two goats on atonement, the goat is taken to the wilderness, uninhabited desert it was. And I know we've read that when an unclean spirit goes out, you know, in Matthew 12, 43, 45, we might turn there, Matthew 12, see if I've got the right. Matthew 12, verse 43. I'll come back here to Mark. When an unclean spirit goes out of a man, he goes through dry places seeking rest. It's like they can't find rest. You know, people in this situation, they can't find rest. They're always tossing and turning and doing things. They can't really relax. Seeking rest and finds none. And then the demon says in 44, which I mentioned earlier, then he says, I will return to my house from which I came. And when he comes, he finds it empty, swept, and in order. Then he goes and takes with him seven other spirits more wicked than himself. And they enter and dwell there, and the last state of that man is worse than the first. So shall it be also be with the with this wicked generation. Sobering talk takes, you know, when demons are cast out. They probably was thinking there back to Mark 5 that, hey, our economy's ruined. Please leave before something else bad happens. So, even so, without getting totally off track here, when Christ returns, what will people say? If we look in the book of Revelation, are they going to be, welcome, Jesus? or are they going to be grinding their teeth and cursing God? So just as these people, they came back, hey, leave, depart. People may, even then, in the future, wish that he would depart and just leave us alone. We were good in Babylon, like the Israelites. They got out of Egypt. Well, back then, we had food. You know, we had some good things. So when these people returned, they don't really grasp what's going on. And they say, please, leave us. When Jesus returns, people will wish he would depart and leave them alone. We know in Matthew 24, it says, all the tribes of the earth will mourn. It won't be a big celebration, will it? It will be for us. But the world says the people will mourn. And even in Revelation chapter 9, it talks about, and they do not want to repent. They don't want to repent. And when the two witnesses are killed, what do the people do? Men will rejoice over the death of the two witnesses, send gifts back and forth. I mean, you could read that in Revelation chapter 11, verse 9, if you want. And when Babylon falls, people going to be happy? No, in Revelation 18, 11, it says, the merchants weep over Babylon falling. You know, these people, you'd think they'd be rejoicing when they came. No, please depart. Leave us alone. Yeah, the merchants will weep over Babylon falling, and it's the best thing that could be happening, but people don't realize it. So back to Mark chapter 5. In verse 18, and when he had gotten to the boat, he who had been demon-possessed begged him that he might be with him. Hey, this man wanted to go with Jesus. What did Jesus say? Actually, Jesus said, no, you can't go with me, but he gave him a work to do, just as he has us. He said, however, Jesus did not, in verse 19, permit him, but said to him, go home to your friends and tell them what great things the Lord has done for you and how he has had compassion on you. He said, you go home and you tell people. How many times, other places we read, Jesus heals someone, he says, don't tell anybody. Then he told this man, go home and tell. And what did the man do in verse 20? And he departed and began to proclaim in Decapolis all that Jesus had done for him. And in the margin, my Bible says 10 cities. This guy, I mean, there could be a whole book in the Bible written what this man did. That's all that's written. Someday, I'm sure there will be something. He did something. Just one day changed his whole course from living in tombs, cutting himself, to being a man who, you could say, is proclaiming the gospel. So that's where he went. He did it. Jesus gave him a commission, and he did it. At a later time, I've wondered if what this man did caused many to come and hear Jesus and be healed. If we turn over to Mark chapter 7, just over, in verse 31, here Jesus again is in the area. Mark 7:31. Again, departing from the region of Tyre and Sidon, Gentile area, he came through the midst of the region of where? Decapolis, to the Sea of Galilee. Remember where the man was? Then they brought him one who was deaf and had an impediment of speech, and they begged him to put his hand on him, took him aside, put his finger in his ear, and said, "Be open." And his ears were open to tell. In this case, he commanded them that they should tell no one, but the more he commanded them, the more widely. And in chapter 8, in those days, multitudes being very great and having nothing to eat, Jesus called his disciples to him and said to them, he had compassion on them. And he fed 4,000 people. This was at another day. Why did all these people come in this Gentile area, Decapolis? Could it have been because of what this former demon-possessed man did? Jesus told him, it says back in Mark 5, and in verse 20, and he departed and began to proclaim in Decapolis all that Jesus had done for him, and all marveled. One man, what he did. So we see a lot of things could happen. And, you know, we could go on with other scriptures in this, Matthew 15:29 and 30:31, where Jesus skirted the Sea of Galilee and great multitudes came. And Jesus didn't want to send them away hungry. And he, with 7 loaves and a few fishes, he fed 4,000. This is that unbelievable things. You know, that was, I won't turn to Matthew 15, but if you wanted to read it sometime. But back to Mark 5. In verse 21, now when Jesus, he just told the man, go, tell what you has happened to you and what Jesus had done for him, and all marveled. In verse 21, now when Jesus had crossed over again by boat to the other side, so he went back, a multitude gathered to him, and he was by the sea. So here we are. Now Jesus is at the other side. And what happens in verse 22? One of the rulers of the synagogue, what I see is a ruler, number 752, director of the synagogue, an important person. In verse 20, and behold, one of the rulers of the synagogue came, Jairus by name, and when he saw him, he fell at his feet. Whose feet? He fell at Jesus' feet. He was worshiping Jesus. He fell at his feet. And what did he do? He begged him earnestly, saying, my little daughter lies at the point of death. Come and lay your hands on her that she may be healed. So this man went to Jesus and said, heal my daughter. So Jesus went with him, and a great multitude followed him, there in verse 24. The man had asked him to lay hands on her, on his little daughter. So verse 24, what? A great multitude followed him. Then, here they're moved, they're going on. Here we're still talking about Jesus' day, great multitude. And a certain woman had a flow of blood for 12 years. She was unclean, supposedly untouchable. by the Jews. I don't know what kind of life she had had. Here's maybe two extremes of people that really having a hard time. The demon-possessed man, here's a woman. So in verse 26, had suffered many things from many physicians and had spent all that she had and was no better, but rather she grew worse. Verse 27, when she heard about Jesus, well, she heard about him somehow. She came behind him in the crowd and touched his garment. She was unclean. She didn't touch him. She touched his garment. And immediately she was healed, wasn't she? Why would she touch his garment? You've probably read, I'll turn there for a minute, to Malachi 4, verse 2. Prophecy, Malachi 4, verse 2. But to you who fear my name, the Son of Righteousness shall arise with what healing in his wings. And there that would mean like the edge of the garment. And there's other places where people would touch the edge of Jesus' garment. I think in Luke 8:43 and other places. And with healing in his wings, and you shall go out and grow fat like stall-fed calves. Yes. It's like the flap or the quarter, the uttermost part of the cloth, like we say the west wing of a building. So this is like the edge of the garment. I don't know, maybe that's where the apostles later came up with the anointing cloth. I don't, you know, they touched Jesus' garments and we anoint cloths and send them. I don't know. That's one of my own thoughts. So she was, now back to Mark. We could read a, just go on over to Mark 6, and we see an example there in verse 56 of another time. Mark 6, verse 56. Wherever he entered into villages, cities, or country, they laid the sick in the marketplace and begged him that he might just touch the hem of his garment. And as many as touched him were made well. So, this woman was made well, wasn't she? Back in Mark 5. She touched the hem. And here's the thing, he wasn't going there to heal her. He was going somewhere else. He didn't even know she was there, did he? Did he even know? Because he said, here's this woman, immediate healing. In Mark 5:28. Where am I? I'm not in the right place. There I am. 28, for she said, if only I may touch his clothes, I shall be made well. She knew. I think she knew about that prophecy in Malachi. Because she said, if only I could touch. And other people did too, as we read there in Mark 6. Immediately, verse 29, the fountain of her blood was dried up, and she felt in her body that she was healed of the affliction. Tremendous miracle ending 12 years of trouble and pain on this woman. And in verse 30, and Jesus immediately, knowing in himself that power had gone out from him, turned around in the crowd and said, who touched me? He wasn't planning to go heal her. He said, who touched me? So just on his way to do something else, a woman's disease of 12 years is healed. Now that's getting quite a bit done. you know, you're just going along. Oh, yeah, here's another one that's been sick 12 years. Cast out so many thousand demons. Heal a woman from 12 years of misery. Who touched me? And, of course, the multitude thronging him. And you say, who touched me? In verse 32, and he looked around to see her who had done this thing. But the woman, fearing and trembling, knowing what had happened to her, come and fell down before him and told him the whole truth. And he said to her, daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your affliction. Immediately healing, he gave help to the helpless, just on his way to help another person. And so in Mark 5, then verse 35, while he was still speaking, some came from the ruler of the synagogue's house who said, your daughter is dead. Why trouble the teacher any further? Verse 36, as soon as Jesus heard the word that was spoken, he said to the ruler of the synagogue, do not be afraid, only believe. And he permitted, in verse 37, no one to follow him except Peter, James, John, and the brother of James. Then he came to the house of the ruler of the synagogue and saw a tumult of those who wept and wailed, meaning the child is dead. When he came in, he said to them, why make this commotion and weep? Child's not dead, but sleeping. Okay, you can remember when, let's see if I wrote it down, when Lazarus died, Jesus said, he's sleeping. And you know, how many people are sleeping in Christ? You know, the child's not dead, but sleeping. And they ridiculed him, but when he had put them outside, he took the father and the mother of the child and those who were with him, and they entered where the child was lying. Then he took the child by the hand and said to her, I can't read that, which is translated, little girl, I say to you, arise. He's speaking in Aramaic. This is translated into Greek, but only believe. But we know he told them, only believe. We know that in Hebrews 11 it says, faith is the substance of things hoped for, things not seen. And that's how we live. We live not by sight, but by faith. And he said the child's just sleeping. And we know Lazarus, he said he was sleeping. That'd be in John 11, verse 11 through 14. I won't turn there, but you could read that if you want. So verse 41, he took the child by the hand and said to her, you know, little girl, arise. In verse 43, and he commanded them strictly that no one should know it. And he said that something should be given to her to eat. He noticed, I mean, he's aware people need to eat. We need to go back there and eat. You know, the girl's, I don't know how long she'd been sick. Give her something to eat. And two, that would definitely prove, hey, she really is alive. This isn't just a vision. Jesus was compassionate, and he was aware of people's needs, you know. So what did Jesus do in a day? Well, he preached the truth. He got in a boat. He took a nap. He stilled the raging waters of a sea. He cast out multiple demons. And he totally changed a man's life. And this man took what Jesus said and he went, and I guess he preached the truth. Apparently, this man then went, and apparently he changed the lives of many people. The events of one day. When Jesus came back to the area, over 4,000 came to hear and be healed. He healed a woman who had been sick for 12 years. He raised a girl who was dead. What can one man do in a day? I mean, try to follow those footprints. I mean, what could one man do in a day? Well, we can use what Christ provides, you know, for our personal growth. You know, the church, UCG, has so many articles and booklets and magazines. We could spend all year just going through them. Study papers on dating, voting, principles of Sabbath observance. I don't know if you could get through them in a year. And then, of course, the Holy Scriptures, which are the most we should be studying, time should be given to. You know, because Paul warned that when he departed that grievous wolves among us would rise up. So we need to be prepared, you know, because things can happen if we're not prepared as that. You know, my experience has been, in other words, people aren't led astray by me or Mr. Caping. They're led astray by people of influence. And so we need to be aware of that. You know, we're always on alert for outside influence, aren't we? Oh, yeah. We're going to be really careful. Those people over there, they worship so-and-so. But Jesus warned us to be very watchful. You know, Paul said, from within you, ravenous wolves will arise. The demon-possessed man was given a commission, and that's what he did. He did it, apparently. We've been given a commission. Jesus healed a damaged woman. He raised a dead child. And we have to remember that all authority has been given, Jesus said, to me. That is going to be in Matthew 28. Verse 18 through 20, that all authority has been given to him. He had authority to cast out how many demons, I don't know. So what are we doing personally in one day? You know, we might ask, how effective are we as individuals in the church? You know, are we a light? Are we an example? Are we about our Father's business? Are we supporting of God and the work that He's called us to do? You know, we live one day at a time. What a difference a day makes. We don't know what tomorrow will be, do we? No. So what is the day in the life of me? I could ask, Gerald, what's a day in you? What have you done? What is a day in your life? You know, God, in the sixth day, God made man. God made man one day, culminating in Christ's return, first as a man, then he will return, and man becomes the sons of God. What a difference a day makes.